I'm Leslie Wise, and this is a continuation of our discussion of ethics and jurisprudence. We are now on to the jurisprudence aspect of this course, and we have done a bit of an introduction to malpractice by way of defining malpractice and giving the four parts of the malpractice formula. So we want to continue with our discussion there of malpractice and some of the concepts surrounding that. One of the things that it's important to remember is that a doctor must uphold a standard of care. And the standard of care is what is normally and reasonably practiced by normal, average, and prudent members of the profession. So you must practice in at least an average manner according to what the average practitioner does. Couple of concepts here that you may or may not be familiar with. One is that a doctor may refuse to treat any patient or accept any patient. A doctor has no obligation whatsoever, legally or otherwise, to accept every patient that comes in the door seeking care. The doctor may selectively deny or accept patients for care. One of the reasons that you might determine that you didn't want to accept a patient is that you may feel that you didn't have the skills, the knowledge necessary to treat a patient or take care of a patient in the appropriate and reasonable and average manner. As long as you disclose that to the patient and tell them that you don't feel you have the necessary skills and knowledge, you may refuse care and have no obligation to the patient. The patient can't sue you for not accepting them as patients. There's no mandatory or obligatory accepting of patients. If you don't make, as a doctor, if you don't make a specific contractual promise to the patient of a guarantee of cure, it is not implied that you have made a guarantee. A guarantee of cure is only held to be there, and has been held this way in the courts, when the doctor makes a specific promise or guarantee. In the absence of that, there is not considered to be a guarantee of cure. A patient can't sue you simply because things didn't go the way the patient desired. If a patient has an illness and you treat the illness or provide care for that problem, and the results aren't what you like, the patient doesn't get better, that in and of itself is certainly not malpractice. That is just the way things happen sometimes. But if you did make a specific promise or guarantee, then you may be held liable for a guarantee of cure, and you could be found negligent and perhaps guilty of malpractice in that case. So by accepting a patient, a doctor does not necessarily imply that he or she possesses the highest level of skills. You don't hold yourself out to be in the highest level. You hold yourself out to be average. The difference here is if you're a general practitioner of your profession, you have the obligation to practice at an average level, not at the most superior level. When a doctor uses the term specialist of some sort, specializing in those words, or the term specialist in, or specializing in certain kinds of cases, or that word in and of itself carries with it a little extra burden. When you suddenly call yourself a specialist, you have stepped up your standard of care. The standard of care has gotten higher because you're a specialist. And if you call yourself a specialist, then you have to perform at the level of a specialist, and your obligation to have the adequate knowledge and skills bumps you up to the level of the knowledge and skills of the average specialist, not the average practitioner. So you be careful calling yourself a specialist or implying that you specialize in certain kinds of conditions or certain kinds of care if in fact you are not a specialist. If in fact you have some specialty designation you have taken extra coursework and you have become certified and are a specialist, then you certainly may call yourself that, but the burden that goes with the privilege is that you now have a higher standard of care. If you call yourself a chiropractic radiologist or a chiropractic orthopedist or a chiropractic neurologist or a sports chiropractor, you now have a little different standard of care. Your standard of care has been bumped up to the level of other specialists designating themselves in the same way. So be careful when you're using that term. In South Carolina, the Board of Examiners has ruled and has passed regulations that specifically prohibit you from using the term, the word specialist, unless in fact you are a certified specialist in one of two or three accepted areas of specialty. One of those is a diplomate in the American Board of Chiropractic Orthopedics, a ADCO. The other is a diplomate in the American Board of Chiropractic Radiology, a DACBAR, and there are some other specialty designations, especially in other states, but in South Carolina there are only two or three things that you may call yourself a specialist in. Those, to be a specialist, you have to have completed coursework, passed some exams, and have been granted the privilege and right of using the designation specialist. So don't call yourself a specialist if you don't in fact have some credentials. Some chiropractors use terminology and they don't quite use it the way it's meant or mean it the way it's used. If you say specializing in upper cervical technique or specializing in the treatment of headaches, that's not the appropriate use under South Carolina licensure of the term specialist. You may say, accepting cases, or I prefer to approach chiropractic in an upper cervical orientation, but the word specialist is reserved for people who actually have a diploma of some sort, a specialist diploma. So if you mean that I prefer to approach chiropractic in an upper cervical orientation, you need to say that rather than I'm a specialist in upper cervical. There really is no designated specialty in upper cervical technique that I know of, at least not acceptable in South Carolina. There's another concept that needs to be brought up, and we already mentioned the fact that the way the standard of care is established in malpractice cases, the way we determine whether or not you were negligent is through the use of an expert witness. And an expert witness is someone who is admitted into the court system as an expert witness by the judge. It is determined that he or she is an expert, and an expert then may give his or her opinion. Now, a regular witness in a regular court situation may not give an opinion. You know, if you're called in as a witness in a car wreck, you may only testify as to information received by your senses. What you saw, what you heard, what you felt, what you tasted, what you smelled. Okay, your senses are the limits of what you can testify about. No opinions allowed. However, if you are admitted as an expert witness, then you may give your opinion. If you are deemed to be an expert, then you may render your opinion. And an expert witness in a malpractice case is called upon to give an opinion. And the opinion given is, in your opinion, did the doctor in question fall below the standard of care, or did the doctor uphold the standard of care? What is your opinion? Given all the facts that you're given, you may state your opinion. So that's how expert witnesses work. An additional little fact about expert witnesses is this, that an expert witness in a case must be of the same school of thought as the person being accused in the case. You can't bring in a person from a different specialty to give an opinion about how a doctor should have taken care of a patient. In other words, the standard of care that an expert witness can testify about is only the standard of care of his own school of thought. And so we call this the school rule. It's a legal concept having to do with the fact that expert witnesses may only testify in their own area of expertise. They can't go outside that. They stay in their school of thought. And it has nothing to do with what school you attended, but it has to do with your school of thought or your school of healing, to which you of which you are a member. In other words, an orthopedic surgeon can't come in and testify as to the standard of care for a chiropractor. A dentist can't testify as to the standard of care for a chiropractor. It would have to be a chiropractor testifying as to the standard of care for a chiropractor. So, recognizing that you must have a person from your own school of thought, that is, as an expert witness, one of the hard things to get sometimes in a malpractice action is to find an expert witness who will agree with your stand that you upheld the standard of care or didn't uphold the standard of care, whatever the case may be. Finding an expert witness that agrees with you sometimes is tough. And it has to be a person from your own school of thought. So the school rule says that an expert witness must be from the same school of thought. The schools of thought that are generally accepted within the legal bounds of malpractice are defined as follows. We generally discuss the school of thought of allopathy. The allopathic physician is the standard medical doctor in America today who practices allopathic medicine. And if you are within the scope of allopathic medicine, then you must have an allopath testifying as an expert witness. Homeopathy is an accepted school of thought. Homeopathy was very, very popular in the United States up until the early part of the 20th century. After that, allopathy sort of took over as the major school, leaving homeopathy as a small minority school of thought. However, in Great Britain, in India, and certain European countries, homeopathy is the major school of thought. What designates homeopathy different from allopathy are the different types of remedies that they use, the different types of medicines and cures that they use. Homeopathy goes along with the concept of like cures like. If you have a fever, we'll give you an agent that would cause a fever in a normal person. So it's sort of the inoculation school of thought. Whereas allopathy, if you have a fever, we'll give you an agent, chemical, medicine, cure, that is known to lower fevers. So it's using the effect of the remedy is different than the effect of the disease. Whereas in homeopathy, the effect of the remedy is the same as the disease. Osteopathy is a school of thought. Osteopathy as a separate school of thought than allopathy is only slightly different anymore. Most osteopaths these days practice medicine. And the only different thing that an osteopath may do is, in some occasions, they may do an osteopathic manipulation. Osteopathic colleges now are largely medical schools. Osteopathic physicians largely practice medicine, but they may have a little orientation toward osteopathic manipulations. It is said that osteopaths manipulate to remove pressure on blood vessels and nerves. You know, that's a legal definition of the practice of osteopathy. Chiropractic is a separate and distinct school of healing arts thought. Chiropractic has been accepted into the legal definitions. It may interest you to know that in Black's Law Dictionary, chiropractic is defined as the manipulation of joints, especially the spine, to combat abnormal functioning of the nerve system. So that may interest you to know that you are a combatant against abnormal functioning of the nerve system. Another school of thought that sometimes surprises people is the Christian Science practitioner. Christian Science practitioners practice a type of healing based on prayer and mind over matter. Christian Science practitioners have a standard of care. They are licensed or certified. They are a standard school of thought within the healing arts, and as such are recognized that way. A Christian Science practitioner who falls below the standard of care for Christian Science practitioners may be found negligent and may be guilty of malpractice if he doesn't practice appropriately and practice right. Naturopathy is recognized and has been for a long time. Naturopathy is described as the cure of disease by natural means, using heat, air, water, and herbs, natural substances. Chiropractic and naturopathy sometimes have crossed paths. A number of chiropractic colleges have in the past granted chiropractic degrees and naturopathic degrees. Many chiropractors were granted dual diplomas when they graduated from school. They would get a DC and an ND degree. And back in the 40s and the 50s, many chiropractors were dually licensed and practiced as such. Along in the 1950s and early 60s, there was a wave of de-licensure on the part of the naturopaths. Naturopaths were de-licensed in some states, leaving those people with joint degrees only with one degree. So if you were a DC-ND and your ND got made illegal, you had to paint that out on your sign and just practice as a DC. Some people say this is one of the factors that gave rise to the chiropractor jack of all trades. That a chiropractor who had previously been an ND, who got de-licensed as an ND, just kept on practicing all the skills that he did as an ND, but calling it chiropractic. And that was one of the problems of political chiropractic in the 1960s and 70s. A school of thought called clairvoyant diagnosis. Clairvoyant diagnosis was ruled out by a court as a standard school of healing art thought. And here's the reason that it was ruled out as a school of thought is that it had no standard of care, no standard of care. There are just too many methods of practicing clairvoyant diagnosis. If you are a psychic, you know, you may be a psychic that uses a pendulum, or you may use dream analysis, you may use laying on of hands, all sorts of ways to do your diagnosis. And a court ruled that there is no standard of care that can be measured, because there are just too many different branches of clairvoyant diagnosis that they don't all come together as a standard school of thought. It wasn't because you couldn't have accrediting agencies or you couldn't have a school to teach these skills. It was because they didn't have standard of care that was sort of uniform. So clairvoyant diagnosis was ruled out. So these are some concepts, the school rule and the school of thought situation. When you're accused of malpractice, you can only be evaluated by an expert witness of the same school of thought. This brings up the question, in chiropractic, we have sort of a split in the profession, whether we officially name it or not. There are a couple of schools of thought within the chiropractic profession. A New Jersey court ruling from about 15 years ago actually made the statement that there are two schools of thought in the chiropractic profession. The New Jersey courts designated them as the diagnostic school of thought and the non-diagnostic school of thought. Whether or not chiropractors actually made a medical diagnosis was the differentiating factor. And the New Jersey courts held that the two schools of thought were different. At this point, we have not yet had malpractice cases that hinge on this issue, but it certainly could happen in the future. A chiropractor who adheres to the non-diagnostic school of thought might say, if confronted by a diagnostic school of thought expert witness, wait a minute, you're not from my school. I'm invoking the school rule. You're from a different school of thought than I am, and you have no business testifying as an expert witness against me. I want an expert witness, and I am entitled to an expert witness of my own school of thought. So one of you may be the lucky person who gets to be the at the forefront of this case. I hope it's not, but somebody at some point will probably establish some sort of legal precedent by virtue of the fact that they say and quote the New Jersey court ruling that there are two schools of thought in chiropractic.